Welcome to episode 115 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today on this Friday is Joe Muccia. I think I pronounced that right.
You got it. Yeah, great to be back. Right. Can't wait to get through this.
Yes.
This is a great sequence you got here for me.
That's right. So Joe is a podcaster, historian, battlefield tour guide, and veteran. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, so you're a battlefield tour guide. Have you done tours of some of the places that the guys from Easy Company have been?
Yeah, without a doubt. It's our tent pole tour. I do a Path of Easy Company tour. It's about 2 weeks long. Always occurs in September. And we basically start in Normandy and work our way all the way through the Normandy fighting and into the Netherlands, down into Belgium, and then up into Germany and Austria. And then we finish up in Munich for flights. But 2 weeks time, we hit all the big places, including Brakewore Manor, where I have a very good relationship with Charles, who owns the manor grounds. His family has owned it for several centuries. We're one of a handful of tour companies that are allowed to access the actual gun line.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Is the gun line still there?
The gun line is still there. It's actually being excavated because they're doing LIDAR tests to see if there's any remnants of the battlefield still along the gun line.
Remnants meaning body parts?
No. Detritus of battle. Bullet casings, etc. They're trying to see if there's anything else there. And I believe it's being recorded for some sort of special, although I have to ask Charles, he can give me the lowdown. But it's been under excavation for quite some time, but I don't know what's going to be finished. But you can trace where the gun line was, up where the L-shaped portion of the trenches where the assault began. You can go over to the other field where the Lipton and Ranney tree is, and then up the dog leg of the gun line where the single gun was positioned leads to where the ammunition dump, and then around the back of the field where the Germans were positioned.
Oh, wow.
While the attack was going on.
Wow.
How many
years have you been doing this tour?
The first time I guided was 2016. The first time I did this tour was 2018.
Mm-hmm. So it was after the men were no longer around. So none of the men joined you on these tours.
Correct, but I've been blessed to bring several Easy Company family members back with me, including the family of Rod Bain and Major Strayer's son and grandson.
Oh, wow.
So it's been great. And veterans of other units as well have come out with us. So it's been really rewarding. I don't do it so much for the money as to keep the history going and to put people where all these actions happened, so that they can get a real feel for what they saw in the miniseries, say, and then, what actually happened.
Okay, interesting. And a side question, since you mentioned that Strayer's family, that you've been in touch with them, what did they think about his portrayal? Because he wasn't necessarily portrayed in the best light.
Yeah,
better,
I think...
Better than some of the other, antagonists in the miniseries, but Strayer, They showed him somewhat as a coward in certain scenes where he didn't want to go out into the street, in Carrington.
In talking to his son Butch, I really didn't ask him about that so much because we talked about growing up as a son of Colonel Strayer, and he was very much the Colonel when Butch was mm-hmm. growing up, and very hard boiled about that kind of thing in terms of his desire for discipline. And you have to understand, Strayer was concerned with dealing with up and out, dealing with the regimental headquarters and how the battalion would operate underneath the regimental mm-hmm. command. And whereas he left things to his operations officer and later, which was right. Hester, Clarence Hester, and then later Winters as the XO. So I think it wasn't a nuanced enough performance right. for okay. me. What it really needed to show was he was an astute judge of talent underneath him. And he let those people do their jobs without crawling into their hindquarters about every little
okay.
detail.
That's the way one wants to do it.
Yeah. And, the thing is, at the end of the day, the actor, Phil McKee, is going to do what he's instructed correct. To do mm-hmm. by the director.
And that's coming from the writing and all that stuff also. So yeah.
You know, if they needed somebody to be the punching bag for a scene, they're going to nominate somebody, and just happened in a couple of scenes the Strayer
Right.
character was it. But I having read a lot of his personal correspondence with Winters and a number of the Easy Vets, and reading their correspondence to him, you get a real feel for how much they did respect him. So I don't know. There's going to be a difference between what the enlisted men saw and what the other officers saw, and how they were going to, it's going to be reflected.
True. All right, cool. So episode 115 begins with the men continuing to sing and ends with Webster starting to yell towards the German prisoners. So we ended things yesterday, and I decided to wait until today to talk about it, that, you know, the men are all in their transport moving along, and they start singing. And they sing a song. Now, do you know the name and origin of the song they're singing?
I do know it's Gory Gory. It is a classic.
Do you know the real name of it? Not Gory Gory is not the...
Blood Upon the Risers.
That's right. Blood on the Risers. Correct.
Blood on the Risers. Yeah. Classic paratrooper song. I'm glad they were able to incorporate it in the miniseries. It's still sung today by paratroopers. So it's very much still in vogue and still used. And so just a great hat tip to paratrooper culture and history to have that in there.
Yeah, for sure. I love the way that they have it here. The song is sung to the tune of the Battle Hymn of the Republic,
yep.
Which that itself was adapted from a song from the Civil War called John Brown's Body. And so, again, it's just taking the same tune and, you know, making other lyrics for it. So,
yeah, and if your viewers are so inclined, just Google it. Some of the lyrics are pretty gory. They got that fatalistic humor of the paratroopers in there. It's great. It's absolutely great when you think about it.
Okay, well, I was actually just going to read the...
fire away then. More power, go.
Yeah, I'm not going to be singing it, so, you know, I'm just going to read it.
Me neither. Yeah, I don't want anybody turning the video off.
No. Well, the audio. But, And, the idea is it's a song that tells of a fatal training jump of a rookie paratrooper whose parachute didn't open up, eventually having him fall to his death. You know, that's the dark humor of this of this song. So
without a doubt.
He was just a rookie trooper, and he surely shook with fright. He checked off his equipment and made sure his pack was tight. He had to sit and listen to those awful engines roar. You ain't gonna jump no more. And then the chorus is, "Gory, gory, what a hell of a way to die." You know, he ain't gonna jump no more. They say the first sentence three times, and then ain't gonna jump no more. And again, it's great how all of these guys are singing this this song together. Among all of the trucks, and you know, we even get a point where when we see Nixon and Winters listening to it, you know, they even comment on it, and you know, because it's very prevalent. You know, I guess they're not in an area where they're really concerned about the you know, about the enemy, so you know, why not sing as much as you can. So the second verse.
This is very much a race for territory at this point. Again, they're trying to cut off German units and get them to surrender. But yeah, just a great way to show both those things happening at the same time. The stress relief of singing the song, but also the race that they're in the middle of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. "Is everybody happy?" cried the sergeant, looking up. Our hero feebly answered, "Yes." And then they stood him up. He jumped into the icy blast, this static line had hooked, and he ain't going to jump no more. And then once again, you go through the chorus. Then the third verse is, "He counted long, he counted loud, he waited for the shock. He felt the wind, he felt the cold, he felt the awful drop. The silk from his reserve spilled out and wrapped around his legs, and he ain't gonna jump no more." Then the fourth verse is, "The riser swung around his neck, connectors cracked his dome. Fence and lines were tied in knots around his skinny bones. The canopy became a shroud, he hurtled to the ground, and he ain't gonna jump no more." The fifth verse is, "The days he lived and loved and laughed kept running through his mind. He thought about the girl back home, the one he'd left behind. He thought about the medic corpse and wondered what they'd find. and he ain't gonna jump no more. The sixth verse is, the ambulance was on the spot, the Jeeps were running wild. The medics jumped and screamed with glee, rolled their sleeves and smiled, for it's been a week or more since the last unit failed. He ain't gonna jump no more. And then it continues and says, he hit the ground, the sound was splat, his blood went spurting high. His comrades, they were heard to say, oh, a hell of a way to die. He lay there rolling around in the welter of his gore, and he ain't gonna jump no more. And then the final verse is, there was blood upon the risers, there were brains upon the chute. Intestines were a dangling from his paratrooper suit. He was a mess, they picked him up and poured him from his boots, and he ain't gonna jump no more. So yes, it is slightly graphic, but you know, the humor, the dark humor fits in here really well. You know, I'm very happy that they allowed us to see these guys you know, singing this song. Because again, it's also part of the whole idea of camaraderie and, you know, lack of a better term, band of brothers. You know, these guys, you know, have something very much in common, and that's
that paratrooper esprit de corps, in there. Like you said, the brotherhood of it and the shared experiences, and it all comes out as they're singing in this great panoramic shot as they work their way through the different trucks to see the different cast of characters, and many of them we've grown to love by this time, nine episodes.
That's right. And also the shot, they give us an amazing shot of the German countryside, you know, showing that, okay, here, you know, we just seen these guys in, you know, in some really bad places, but it's still, you know, these are battles that are going on in beautiful places.
Yeah, without a doubt. And there's a great shot of the long shot of the convoy. Yes. And for historically speaking, you'll notice the number of deuce and a half trucks that the guys are riding in, but also ducks, amphibious deuce and a halves, which were, I have a lot of photographs of the 506th moving into Germany, and they utilize the ducks quite a bit. So it's very accurate to see those in the sequences.
The idea being that if they have to get through water along the way, they have the those transports?
Yep. Capability to do so, yeah.
Right. And, you know, as the singing continues in the background, you know, Winters turns around in his Jeep and says to Nixon, goes, "You okay, Nix?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm fine." And, you know, he goes, "She hates that dog."
He's still steaming over the letter. It's just, it's beautiful. He's just cooking. He's just cooking. The brain's working.
That's right. And you know, the camera continues to focus on Nixon, you know, as, you know, he's, as we can see that he's really upset, but the music is, you know, the singing is continuing, and he eventually just joins in, and you see him singing also, which is a great way to show that he's getting back into the moment. You know, he's saying to himself, okay, you know, I'm upset about this whole thing about the dog, not about the divorce, about the dog. But, you know, right now I need to focus on where I'm here. I'm with these guys. These are the guys that are going to be keeping me alive and keeping me moving forward. So that's what I want. And, you know, he just sings in. Now, I don't believe we see Winter singing at all. You know, he's smiling along with it, but he's not singing.
Yeah, I don't see him singing, and if I remember correctly, I'll roll it so I can take a look. But I agree with you. I don't think he sings. Plus, they start to zero in on Nix. They move past Winter's head, and it's just on Nix at that point.
Yeah, but he's not moving his lips. So, you know.
He's just got a look on his face like, okay, just let him go through it.
That's right. And then the shot changes, and we see, as you mentioned, the ducks, you know, strolling, going across the countryside. It, what's funny is that, you know, when we see them in the Jeep, it looks like they're moving at a certain speed. And then here it looks like they're moving even slower.
Yeah.
Because as you said, well, if it's a race.
For the tracking shot, they got to do that.
If it's a race, you want these guys to, you know, to get there as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about the mechanization of the United States Army in the later sequence, later portion of the segment. So But yeah, you can't really do the both things at the same time. You can't race and also capture it effectively on film, so they're kind of stuck in that
Exactly.
regard.
But I still like the way they do it. And then we focus in on Liebgott and Webster, who are in the back of one of the trucks. Again, these men are not wearing helmets so that we can tell who they are. My assumption is that when you're moving towards enemy territory, you're going to be having your helmet on, for obvious reasons. But
Oh yeah, if you're expecting contact, you're gonna have that lid
that's
on.
right. And what's nice is that after everything that happened in part eight, we see that Liebgott and Webster are now friends again. Liebgott was the one who was riding
Yeah.
Webster the most, but here he's able to give the two of them are having this conversation. Now Webster's eating something. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, he's got a K ration out. It's a K ration, so it could have been any combination of ham and eggs, something of that nature. Yeah, not very appetizing.
That's
Better
true.
than nothing.
That's true.
The GI spoon, which most of the guys they told me either kept them in their canteen cover, nestled between the cover and the canteen, or in their pockets on the front of their combat uniform.
Well,
And you could use it for a whole host of things, including digging in if you had
oh,
to.
you can dig. You can. It was a strong enough spoon that you could actually
Yeah,
move dirt with it. Wow.
I have a couple of examples in my collection. Yeah, I mean you can't use it like a shovel, but I mean you can use it to scrape and get down below the
Right. You
crust
just
and
need to
start
make
digging.
sure to clean it
You can use
before
your
you
hand.
start eating your K-rations.
Yeah,
But then again,
of course.
you might want to eat. You might eat dirt also along the way. I'm always reminded of things like this when when I was in basic training years and years ago. I remember I was walking with a friend of mine, and he had like a sandwich that had like chocolate spread on it or something. And he dropped it, and it landed on the ground, and he picked it up, and it was filled with tons of sand, and he just brushed off a little bit of it and just ate it. And I was like, all right,
Yeah, I think all of us at CERT probably have a
exactly.
little
That's
dirt in
right.
us
It's a little
somewhere.
crunchy, And then Liebgott says, there's gonna be good times, Webb. And Webb just looks at him. Webster doesn't really know what he's talking about. He says, when we get home, I mean. Because the line sounds a little strange. That they're on their way, into Germany or in further into Germany, and he's if he's referring to that. And he goes, first thing I'm going to do is get my job back at the cab company in Frisco, make a killing off all those f***ing sailors coming home, Now what's really funny is he assumes that they're going to get home before the sailors do.
Yeah.
The
Yeah.
idea is that most of these guys are going to get home around the same time, but it's going to take a long time for them to get home. Have you ever seen the movie The Best Years of Our Lives?
Yes.
Okay, so you see there, you have three guys that are coming from completely different areas that all happen to be getting home at the same time, which makes sense. It's not as if the infantry in Europe are going to get at home at a certain time, and the men in the Pacific are going to get home at a different time. It's just a question of logistics, which was not something that was very simple to deal with anyway.
Yeah, very much so.
Because
And I think, we talked about the Pacific in your last episode, and there's a scene at the end when they're returning home and they're talking about how late it is. They were in like late 1945 or early 46, which is, and that sequence is completely made up because Sledge ends up serving in China after his time, after almost everybody else has already left to go home. So, I mean, some of that stuff's a little contrived, but like you said, the vast ocean differences with the Pacific versus the Atlantic, and then you have high point guys, which I'm sure you're going to cover in your next when you do your segments for episode 10. Some of these guys, if they've been in a lot of battles and they've been wounded and they had decorations, they're going to get to go home a little bit earlier than some of the others. And Liebgott had been wounded
Right.
once for sure, maybe
On October
twice.
5th, he was injured in when they were in
The crossroads on the
the crossroads.
island.
Yeah.
Yep.
He was.
So it's quite possible that Liebgott got home a bit earlier than everybody else, but
He
especially,
didn't know
guys
that
who are
at this
sailing from the Pacific.
point. That's right.
So, I mean, theoretically, his idea is correct.
Yes, that's true.
Interesting. He starts to talk. I guess you're going to get to it. I won't preempt you. Go ahead. Fire
And then
away.
he goes, "Then I'm going to find me a nice Jewish girl with great big soft teeth and a smile to die for. Marry her. Then I'm going to buy a house, a big house with lots of bedrooms for all the little leavegots we're going to make. She ought to like that." Now, I've mentioned this before, and you know, we know where the error comes from, but Liebgott was not a Jew.
No, he wasn't. His family came out basically right after the miniseries, or just a little while after, and said he's not Jewish. But the interesting thing is, there's another vet from the company, a guy named Ed Shames, who was Jewish,
Right.
and he basically said, "I never saw him go to a service, but I always thought he was Jewish." So it's kind of got this weird. It's trying to figure out his motivations of why he was brutal to the Germans. He
Right.
was a brutal guy.
And he also knew German. So the question was, is, you know, he was one of the interpreters. So, you know,
yes.
Or translators. So if it's someone who knows German, you know, again, the way he's portrayed here, and it's even mentioned in the book that he was a Jew. Okay.
Yeah.
Which surprises me that you said that the, you know, that his family came out after the miniseries and said something. Well, maybe they should have read it in the book.
Well, you know, I think, you know, you got to remember that with digital communications nowadays is not
Right.
the same as it was back then. So they might not have seen the book. They might even not even know about it. He was one of those guys that went back home, never talked about the war, never went to a reunion. So his family probably had no idea there was a book coming out about them. But in his case, you know, it's interesting to think about what his motivations were. If they were German,
Right.
maybe he was ashamed of what Germans were doing, and that's what made him so brutal.
Right.
And he never decided to dissuade anybody to the idea that he might be
Right.
Jewish, but he probably never spoke about it
Correct.
either.
I mean, again, in the miniseries, they use that numerous times. You know, there's the whole fight on the transport on the way
On the
on the
Samaria,
Samaria.
yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, there's also the point where Winters, you know, takes away all his bullets and gives him one bullet because he thinks he's going to kill all the, you know, all the prisoners,
Yeah.
you know, which again,
And that was true to
yeah.
life, but it was already starting to affect him in Bastogne. He was already starting to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, although they had no idea what it was. And Winters oftentimes would pull him back to perform interpreter duties or just make him a runner to get him off the
Right.
line. So he was obviously suffering from some sort of PTSD. So it's interesting to see him so, you know, kind of jovial here, but it'll change
Yes. Well, again,
soon
it'll
enough.
change soon enough. But the question is, you know, is it for what reason? And again, you know, we'll talk about that. I'm going to talk about that next week with a different guest. But, you know, the idea is that, you know, the fact that they're portraying him here as a Jew is what makes him so emotional later on. You know, so going back to what you said, you know, we know that he had a strong hatred for what the Germans were doing, but it wasn't because he was a Jew, and we don't know the actual motivation for it. So then, you know, how would that necessarily play out later on?
So we can talk about that later on, but I do want to address the elephant in the room when it comes to, you know, why they leaned into the Liebgott being a Jew portion of this. And I think part of it, there's some similarities between the Blythe issue, and I'm sure you
Oh,
covered
yeah.
this. The men, almost to a man, thought Blythe was killed. And again, you didn't have global communications back when they started writing the Bible and the for the series, and the series itself. So when you go to somebody like Bill Garnier or Babe Heffron, well, Babe wasn't there when Blythe was hit, but others told the writers that Blythe had been killed. Well, that very same occurrence may have happened with regard to whether or not Liebgott was a Jew. The other vets in the company may have believed he was Jewish. And when the writers approached them,
that's right,
they told
100%.
them that.
And there's
no way really to fact check that at the time. So not only that, you can then lean on that as like he becomes
the token. Right.
Angel of
Exactly.
death, right? And so they leaned into it in terms of storytelling. So it's very understandable how they got from point A to point B, if you think back of
Oh,
the
for sure.
similarities between this and the Blythe piece.
I completely agree with that. There's no question about that. For me, the idea was is how come there was never any, there were never any red flags, both with the Blythe incident and with this one. From, you know, they were talking to the men, but you know, they, I guess they never reached the point where they were trying to contact the families, because again, you know, 25 years ago, it was more difficult to contact people the way that you can today. Today, you just look on Facebook, you're like, oh, okay, this is Liebgott's grandson, so let's talk to him and ask him what he said. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Maybe yes, maybe no. You know.
So it's really interesting how we got to this point. But people tend to look at things like this in with a modern optic, and really have to look at it from the optic of the time of the production. And I think it would offer a little bit more understanding. In talking to Eric Jendrenson this past weekend, he basically said one of my biggest regrets was the Blythe thing. Because he, and not only that, you have to understand too, the sale of rights to the miniseries and the production companies that owned it and who owns it still is still a battle. I believe Warner Brothers has got their hands all over it now, even though it's an HBO property. When you have that many people who own the rights to it, or the rights change so often, it makes it exceedingly difficult to go in and make changes later on.
Right, of course.
So people are always asking, well, why didn't they just go and change the crawl at the end of episode 3? Well, because it's tough to find out who owns things. And generally, people don't want to spend money at that point. I hate to say it, but a lot of it comes down to the almighty dollar.
Right, of course. And again, how can you make a change? You make a change in what people see now, but you can't change the you know, every all the videos, DVDs, you know, anything that people have over the last 25 years. From that perspective, you know, so on the one hand, it's a little bit of a blot, but on the other hand, they got a hell of a lot more right than wrong here. You know,
they certainly did.
You can point to you know, maybe on one, or let's even go and say on two hands, you know, little things that they possibly got wrong, but that's nothing in the haystack of needles of all the things they got right.
It's not for the want of trying, that's for sure.
No, that's true. And I mean, even I mean, one of the other glaring mistakes, the crawl at the end of the second part, you know, where they talk about that, you know, they teach what Winter's, you know, Winter's maneuvers at you know, at West Point,
West
or wherever
Point.
It is.
Yeah.
And you know, I spoke with Eric Flint, and he just laughed at that and said that he's talked to so many people. You know, are you familiar with Eric Flint?
Yes. And like him, I have spoken to many people and have not had any one of them tell me it's part of the formal curriculum
That's
at West
right. Exactly.
So it might be taught in an instant, in a moment in time where you use it as an example, but it's not part of the curriculum.
Exactly.
So,
Right. So again,
interesting, but
it's great to see it and say to yourself, wow. But then when you know that it really didn't happen, you know, it takes a
again,
little air out of the balloon, but still.
To me, it still doesn't diminish the overall quality of the product. So, I
no,
mean,
not at all. Not at all.
People are going to gripe about something. They're going to find something to gripe about. To me, I look at the work in its totality.
Yeah, for sure.
And it remains a massively impressive piece of television.
Correct. I completely agree with you. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I do things this way minute by minute, because, you know, it's out of love for the movie or miniseries, not because, you know, I'm looking to find faults in it. When you do find faults along the way, okay, find faults. It happens. You know, that's the way these things are. But it doesn't make it that it's less interesting to look at afterwards because of that. It, in my opinion, it's actually the opposite. You know, there's certain things that once you see them, you're never going to unsee them. You know, I'll go back to the famous point in Star Wars, you know, where there's a certain scene where you have stormtroopers walking into the room and the third one hits his head. And,
It's a
you
said
know,
you can't unsee that now.
you can't unsee it. Every time you see the movie, you're going to see that. And you're not going to say, oh, this movie's crap because of it. You're gonna laugh about it. And it's the same way here with Band of Brothers.
I think there are two points there that I want to make that you touched on. One of them is, if you look at the things that they got wrong and you contextualize them, you can understand it a little better why they were done. And two, 25 years later, we're still discussing the miniseries in depth. We're still examining it. We're still, as a society, almost a global society, absolutely in love with this miniseries. I would assume they got more right than they got wrong at
Oh,
that point, right?
for sure, for sure. There's no question about that. All right, and then we
back
can,
to our two
yeah,
conversationalists.
that's right. Well, we're finished with Webster and leave that at this point because we'll come back to them, but they're part of the conversation has ended right now. And Webster's listening. He doesn't say anything. Just eating away his K-rations.
Yeah, he's just letting Liebgock roll on that scene, which is really funny.
Exactly. And then we get a shot of Luz next to Janovic, and Janovic's reading something, and he goes, "Hey, Janovic, what you reading?" He goes, "An article." He goes, "No, what's it about?" He goes, "It's about why we're fighting the war." Luz looks at him and goes, "Oh, why are we fighting the war, Genovic?" Genovic goes, "It seems that the Germans are bad, very bad." And Luz looks at him and goes, "You don't say. The Germans are bad, huh?"
Go.
Makes you wonder what article he's reading. Like, what, is this like German propaganda? Is this
Oh no, he's got to be reading Stars and Stripes at
Oh,
that point.
for sure.
But look at watching it, Rick Gomez's facial expressions always cracks me up when I watch this sequence.
It's great, and and what's great is while they're having this conversation, you see Picante in the background, keep standing up and like spitting in the background. You don't know what he's doing. It takes a little while till we're actually gonna know what he's doing. And then Luz turns to Frank. He goes, "Hey, Frank, this guy's reading the article over here. Says the Germans are bad."
So deftly delivered. And look at Matteo is trying to keep a straight face
That's
during
right.
that line delivery as well.
That's right. And we see,
And
we see,
then he
we can see that he's
cracks.
right. We can see that he's brushing his teeth, and he starts laughing as he's brushing his teeth. It's interesting that they've shown us even when they were in Bastogne. Frank was always in the miniseries. He's always using a toothbrush on his teeth. So,
A
it's
consistent theme.
definitely.
Well, with Frank, the real Frank's, 1,000 megawatt smile, I think they were playing into that quite a bit.
Yeah. Makes sense. And
I think Jimmy did a wonderful job of portraying him.
yeah,
And
I
I'm
love
not
the lead
ashamed.
up here.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed to say Jimmy's a good friend. So, I'm always going to heap praise on him. But I knew Frank as well, and he did such a fine job of just capturing Frank's essence, and yeah, just a wonderful piece of acting all the way through for him.
Yeah. And then we're back with Liebgott and Webster, and Liebgott goes, "So what about you, Webb? You learn something new every day, huh?" And Webster looks at him and goes, "Well, I guess I'll finish school first, and then wait a minute. Finish school? You mean all this time you've been talking about Harvard this and Harvard that? You ain't never even finished." He goes, "For one thing, I haven't told you anything." "Oh." And he goes, Yes, I haven't finished." "So what the f what? All right, well, breathe a little, Jesus."
Now it's not Liebgott the character that's the aggressor. He's on the back foot, right?
Right. And
It's a turn of
you see him
events for
backing
him.
down, right? You see him backing down really quickly. And one of the great things about during the shot is you see O'Keefe, next to Liebgott, just like smiling as he's looking up at the countryside, showing the fact that he's just happy to be there. He's not necessarily paying attention to the conversation, but he's happy to be on his way wherever they're going.
Yes. And
And then
nobody's picking on
no, not at all. And Liebgott goes, "F just the way you always talked, we all figured that, hey, you know what? You're right. What the f what? What'd you study?" And he says, "Literature." "Get out of here. Are you serious?" Because I love to read. "Do you?" "Yeah." So it leave that likes to jab him a little bit here. And by leave that saying he likes to read. So I'm sure Webster's thinking to himself, okay, he's going to say he likes to read Shakespeare. He likes to read, some of the classics. And he goes, yeah, I like reading Dick Tracy, Flash Gordon mostly.
Just a great job too. And you got to give Ross McCall a lot of credit and Ian Bailey here. Just the little mannerisms too, the way Ross pulls his cigarette out of the pack and puts it in his mouth. They captured the kind of the GI mannerisms back then. But yeah, really well done. Really, really funny exchange, but also getting to the heart of matters that they're slowly winding their way to the end of the war. And it's interesting to see them have their
They're starting
interaction
to
about
think,
what they want to do.
right. They're starting to think about, what's next. What am I going to do after I'm no longer in this particular situation?
I might
At least
live, and what am I going to do when I'm not wearing olive drab,
that's right. It's nice the way that they're adding this in here a little bit, just to give us a little bit of an idea of what's going on with in these characters' minds, as we're winding down, as you said. And I love the fact that they then show a sign on the side of the road that they're passing that says, "You are now entering enemy territory. Keep on the other." Makes me wonder if they really had that type of thing there, and that the lines kept changing, so they had to keep uprooting this type of sign.
Yeah, generally you'd see them and they'd have some kind of unit marking, like the road you're driving has been cleared courtesy of, and they'd have a unit name on it with a patch painted on it, or there'd be MPs nearby. It's kind of a just stuck in there, but it foot stomps that the war is not over. And although you guys are kind of kicking back in the back of the deuce and a half, it doesn't mean there's no shooting left.
That's right.
So just a
That's right.
nice hat tip to that kind of practice back then.
Exactly. So put your helmets back on. That's what I was saying. Yeah. And then the scene changes, and now we see the men storming into a building, and they kick open a door, and we see that they're entering regular German apartments, and Spears doesn't want to hear any of it, and he just says, he turns actually to the lead guy who's right there, and he goes, "Tell her she's got 5 minutes." And he goes, "Sir, she says they got nowhere to go, but the house next door is." He goes, "Hey, you hear this?" Precanti then points out, and he goes, "This guy says he ain't a Nazi." Why in all of Germany? I've never met one Nazi yet.
All of these sequences are based in reality. A number of the vets all echoed these same feelings. So this is built on the backs of the interviews with the men. They did storm into Germans' houses. Basically, if it was tactically feasible, they would stay within buildings whenever possible. And that meant whoever was in them needed to get out right away. And then two, they were often fed the "I'm not a Nazi" line because they didn't want to be treated the way they know they're going to get treated if they were. So all of these are consistent themes of things that came from the veterans, and it was great to see them incorporated into the scene.
No, the way they added these things in here is just great. And Fears then says, "We're only going to be one night." And he turns to the woman and goes, "You got 4 minutes." And Liebgott then translates it to her, and he goes, "Come on, let's go. Move, all of you, out." And
But there's also that great sequence where I think it's the Pagani character hands the teddy bear to the child, or maybe which one is it? Just to show that they have not lost their humanity altogether.
That's right. You have children, you have kids playing checkers there, and you see the father basically hugging his daughter, and then, as you said, there's the he hands over the teddy bear, even though, okay, we're moving you out of your house, but we're gonna be here for the next day. Just get out, that type of thing.
That also
And then
tells you how fast they were advancing. We're only
that's
going to
right.
be here a day, so you come back, and a lot of times the houses be looted. The conquering
Especially
group.
Spears was there.
There were others. I think they used him as kind of a figurehead for the general to generalize the looting that went on. He did loot too. He wasn't the only one, but there were others who were probably more prolific. but he was definitely one of them. So there, a lot of the guys spoke about the amount of, and this is where Spears is the exception. The amount of looting you did had an adverse correlation to how much combat you've seen. So the folks who saw less combat looted more than the guys who actually saw a lot of combat.
Well, that doesn't make sense with Spears then, because Spears saw a lot of
Exactly.
combat.
Yeah, he bucked that trend.
That's right.
For sure.
Because again, once you know, men who've been in combat have seen things that you know can make you go either way. You know, it can make you say, "Okay, this is now mine," like Spears possibly thought. You know, as he said earlier this week, "Finders keepers." You know, makes sense
There's
from
definitely
his
a Y
perspective.
inter there's definitely a Y intersection or a T intersection when it comes to that. You could either you're too calloused and you don't care and you're going to do what you want to do, or you're overly sensitive because you've seen what happens to your friends, and develop certain sensitivities that prevents you from losing your humanity. So it's you got polar opposites there, and you could go either way. And sometimes you could be right up the middle and have both tendencies.
That's true, also. Right. And then the shot changes, and we see them, you know, basically getting all these people out of the apartment, and then we're up on the roof of a building where we have these two kids that walk across the roof, and then we a great shot where the camera moves up behind them, and then we see, you know, the Allies advancing towards us and the Germans marching away from us. You know, and they're like in
The
the
kids are up on
divide.
an overpass. This is the
That's right.
this is the Autobahn, and the Autobahn was one of Germany's like great achievements prior to the war kicking off. And I really love this expansive shot. It's based on an actual photograph of Allied armies advancing on the American army advancing on the Autobahn. So it's a great tribute to that original photograph.
And they also do a great job of showing the, you know, these defeated soldiers you know, marching along in unison, you know, back away from, I guess, the advancing troops, you know,
Yeah,
from that.
yeah. Wonderful shot here, and I think you're going to get to the line that Winters has. He starts talking about they're marching with pride.
That's
One of
right.
the things that he wrote about extensively in his papers were he detested the Nazis, but he had respect for the Germans as soldiers. So this is kind of a quick hat tip to how he felt about them as military professionals.
Right, which again we'll see, you know, in the scene where he has the where he accepts the surrender, you know, later on.
Yes.
You know, that also is part of it. And Winters then turns to, you know, we see Winters in the Jeep, and he turns to Nixon. And he goes, "Look at them! Even in defeat, they still know how to march with pride." And
Direct
we
hat
see
tip to his
that's
how
right.
he felt.
Mm-hmm. And we can even see that you know, and we'll talk more about this on Monday, but you know, you see a group of officers in a carriage being taken driven by a horse,
Yeah.
you know, as they're continuing to march.
Obviously
And
showing the dichotomy between the two armies at that point.
Exactly. And you know, we see the German officers looking around at, you know, the Allies that are advancing around them. And then we get a shot of Webster on the back of the truck, and he gets up and starts screaming, "Hey, you! Hey, you! That's right, you!" And then he gets cut off. So, you know, everyone, you're going to have to come back on Monday to find out what Webster has to say. You know, is it going to be something from literature? You never know.
Well, we'll find out, won't we?
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. All right. So, Joey, is there anything else you want to say about this particular segment?
No, again, I really like this. There's a lot of subtleties in it. There's a lot of controversy in it, as we talked about, with certain things like the We've Got religious aspect. And then just some really good nods to information that the vets imparted to the writers and that the actors beautifully brought to the screen. So again, I'm very happy to come in and talk about episode 9. Like I said in our previous episode, I usually get asked to talk about the Normandy episodes or the Holland episodes, but this is a nice one for a change. I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, no question about it. I've been enjoying every minute of today and yesterday, and I look forward to having you back on Monday to talk more about all this stuff. So,
Yeah, I can't wait.
Joe, would you like to tell everyone once again where they can find you?
Yeah, once again, I'm a podcaster. You can find my podcast, the We're Not Lost Private Podcast. We're on Patreon. If you want to become a subscriber, that'd be great. Help us keep the lights on and the episodes flowing. You can find the podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, wherever you catch your pods. And hopefully you'll stop by and subscribe and hang out and listen to what we have to say.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So everyone have a great weekend. And Joe and I will be back once again on Monday. But, for anyone paying attention, tomorrow is D-Day. Hopefully, you will find a nice way to remember all the men fought at in Normandy 82 years ago at this point. All right, so I'll be back. We'll be back on Monday. So until then, Curry.
Curry.